Chapter 48. The famous Mr. Joseph Addison. The gentlemen ushers at a table at Kensington, and the guard a very splendid dinner daily at St. James, at either of which ordinaries Esmond was free to dine. Dick Steele liked the guard table better than his own at the gentlemen ushers, where there was less wine and more ceremony. And Esmond had many a jolly afternoon in company of his friend, and a hundred times at least saw Dick into his chair. If there is verity in wine, according to the old adage, what an amiable-natured character Dick's must have been. In proportion as he took in wine, he overflowed with kindness. His talk was not witty, so much as charming. He never said a word that could anger anybody, and only became the more benevolent the more tipsy he grew. Many of the wags derided the poor fellow in his cups, and chose him as a butt for their satire. But there was a kindness about him, and a sweet playful fancy, that seemed to Esmond far more charming than the pointed talk of the brightest wits, with their elaborate repartees and affected severities. I think Steele shone rather than sparkled. Those famous beaux esprits of the coffee houses, Mr. William Congreve, for instance, when his gout and his grandeur permitted him to come among us, would make many brilliant hits, half a dozen in a night sometimes. But, like sharpshooters, when they had fired their shot, they were obliged to retire under cover till their pieces were loaded again, and wait till they got another chance at their enemy. Whereas Dick never thought that his bottle companion was a butt, to aim at only a friend, to shake by the hand. The poor fellow had half the town in his confidence. Everybody knew everything about his loves and his debts, his creditors or his mistress's obduracy. When Esmond first came onto the town, honest Dick was all flames and raptures for a young lady, a West India fortune, whom he married. In a couple of years the lady was dead, the fortune was all but spent, and the honest widower was as eager in pursuit of a new paragon of beauty, as if he had never courted and married, and buried the last one. Quitting the guard table one Sunday afternoon, when by chance Dick had a sober fit upon him, he and his friend were making their way down Jermyn Street, and Dick all of a sudden left his companion's arm, and ran after a gentleman who was poring over a folio volume at the bookshop near to St. James Church. He was a fair, tall man, in a snuff-colored suit, with a plain sword, very sober, and almost shabby in appearance at least, when compared to Captain Steele, who loved to adorn his jolly round person with the finest of clothes, and shone in scarlet and gold lace. The captain rushed up then, to the student of the bookstall, took him in his arms, hugged him, and would have kissed him, for Dick was always hugging and bussing his friends, but the other stepped back with a flush on his pale face, seeming to decline this public manifestation of Steele's regard. "My dearest Joe, where hast thou hidden thyself this age?" cries the captain, still holding both his friend's hands. "I have been languishing for thee this fortnight." "A fortnight is not an age, Dick," says the other, very good-humoredly.
He had light blue eyes, extraordinarily bright, and a face perfectly regular and handsome, like a tinted statue.
"And I have been hiding myself, where do you think?"
"What, not across the water, my dear Joe?" says Steele, with a look of great alarm. "Thou knowest I have always—"
"No," says his friend, interrupting him with a smile. "We are not come to such straits as that, Dick. I have been hiding, sir, at a place where people never think of finding you, at my own lodgings, whither I am going to smoke a pipe now, and drink a glass of sack. Will your honor come?"
"Harry Esmond, come hither," cries out Dick. "Who hast heard me talk over and over again of my dearest Joe, my guardian angel?"
"Indeed," says Mr. Esmond, with a bow, "it is not from you, only that I have learned to admire Mr. Addison. We loved good poetry at Cambridge as well as at Oxford, and I have some of yours by heart, though I have put on a red coat. ..." "O cui canoro blandia sorfio vocale ducis carmen, apostrophe shall I go on, sir?" says Mr. Esmond,
who, indeed, had read and loved the charming Latin poems of Mr. Addison, as every scholar of that time knew and admired them. This is Captain Esmond who was at Blenheim, says Steele. Lieutenant Esmond, says the other, with a low bow, at Mr. Addison's service. I have heard of you, says Mr. Addison, with a smile, as, indeed, everybody about town had heard that unlucky story about Esmond's dowager and the Duchess. We were going to the George, to take a bottle before the play, says Steele : wilt thou be one, Joe? Mr. Addison said his own lodgings were hard by, where he was still rich enough to give a good bottle of wine to his friends, and invited the two gentlemen to his apartment in the Haymarket, whither we accordingly went. I shall get credit with my landlady, says he, with a smile, when she sees two such fine gentlemen as you come up my stair. And he politely made his visitors welcome to his apartment, which was indeed but a shabby one, though no grandee of the land could receive his guests with a more perfect and courtly grace than this gentleman. A frugal dinner, consisting of a slice of meat and a penny loaf, was awaiting the owner of the lodgings. Why, wine is better than my meat, says Mr. Addison. My Lord Halifax sent me the Burgundy. And he set a bottle and glasses before his friends, and ate his simple dinner in a very few minutes, after which the three fell to, and began to drink. You see, says Mr. Addison, pointing to his writing table, whereon was a map of the action at Hochstadt, and several other gazettes and pamphlets relating to the battle, that I too am busy about your affairs, Captain. I am engaged as a poetical gazetteer, to say truth, and am writing a poem on the campaign. So Esmond, at the request of his host, told him what he knew about the famous battle, drew the river on the table aliquo miro, and with the aid of some bits of tobacco pipe showed the advance of the left wing, where he had been engaged. A sheet or two of the verses lay already on the table beside our bottles and glasses, and Dick, having plentifully refreshed himself from the latter, took up the pages of manuscript, writ out with scarce a blotter correction, in the author's slim, neat handwriting, and began to read therefrom with great emphasis and volubility. At pauses of the verse, the enthusiastic reader stopped and fired off a great salvo of applause. Esmond smiled at the enthusiasm of Addison's friend. "Who are like the German burghers," says he, "and the princes on the Moselle. When our army came to a halt, they always sent a deputation to compliment the chief, and fired a salute with all their artillery from their walls, and drunk the great chief's health afterward, did not they?" says Captain Steele, gaily filling up a bumper. He never was tardy at that sort of acknowledgement of a friend's merit. "And the Duke, since he will have me act his grace's part," says Mr. Addison, with a smile and something of a blush, "pledged his friends in return. Most serene elector of Covent Garden, I drink to your highness's health," and he filled himself a glass. Joseph required scarce more pressing than Dick to that sort of amusement. But the wine never seemed at all to fluster Mr. Addison's brains, it only unloosed his tongue. Whereas Captain Steele's head and speech were quite overcome by a single bottle. No matter what the verses were, and, to say truth, Mr. Esmond found some of them more than indifferent, Dick's enthusiasm for his chief never faltered, and in every line from Addison's pen, Steele found a master stroke. By the time Dick had come to that part of the poem, wherein the bard describes as blandly as though he were recording a dance at the opera, or a harmless bout of bucolic cudgeling at a village fair, that bloody and ruthless part of our campaign, with the remembrance whereof every soldier who bore a part in it must sicken with shame, when we were ordered to ravage and lay waste the elector's country, and with fire and murder, slaughter and crime, a great part of his dominions was overrun. When Dick came to the lines, "And vengeance roused the soldier fills his hand with sword and fire, and ravages the land, and crackling flames a thousand harvests burn, a thousand villages to ashes turn. To the thick woods the woolly flocks retreat, and mixed with bellowing herds confusedly bleat. their trembling lords the common shade partake, and cries of infants found in every break. The listening soldier fixed in sorrow stands, loth to obey his leader's just commands. The leader grieves, by generous pity swayed, to see his just command so well obeyed. By this time wine and friendship had brought poor Dick to a perfectly maudlin state, and he hiccuped out the last line with a tenderness that set one of his auditors a-laughing. "I admire the license of your poets," says Esmond to Mr. Addison. Dick, after reading of the verses, was fain to go off, insisting on kissing his two dear friends before his departure, and reeling away with his periwig over his eyes. "Admire your art. The murder of the campaign is done to military music, like a battle at the opera, and the virgins shriek in harmony, as our victorious grenadiers march into their villages. Do you know what a scene it was?" By this time, perhaps, the wine had warmed Mr. Esmond's head to, "Had a triumph you are celebrating? What scenes of shame and horror were enacted, over which the commander's genius presided, as calm as though he didn't belong to our sphere. You talk of the listening soldier fixed in sorrow, apostrophe the leader's grief swayed by generous pity, apostrophe to my belief the leader cared no more for bleeding flocks than he did for infants' cries, and many of our ruffians butchered one or the other with equal alacrity. I was ashamed of my trade, when I saw those horrors perpetrated, which came under every man's eyes. You hew out of your polished verses a stately image of smiling victory. I tell you 'tis an uncouth, distorted, savage idol, hideous, bloody, and barbarous. The rites performed before it are shocking to think of. You great poets should show it as it is ugly and horrible, not beautiful and serene. Oh, sir, had you made the campaign, believe me, you never would have sung it so." During this little outbreak, Mr. Addison was listening, smoking out of his long pipe, and smiling very placidly. "Hat would you have?" says he. "In our polished days, and according to the rules of art, 'tis impossible that the muse should depict tortures, or begrim her hands with the horrors of war. These are indicated rather than described, as in the Greek tragedies, that, I dare say, you have read, and sure there can be no more elegant specimens of composition. Agamemnon is slain, or Medea's children destroyed, away from the scene, the chorus occupying the stage and singing of the action to pathetic music. Something of this I attempt, my dear sir, in my humble way. 'Tis a panegyric I mean to write, and not a satire. Were I to sing as you would have me, the town would tear the poet in pieces, and burn his book by the hands of the common hangman. Do you not use tobacco? Of all the weeds grown on earth, sure the Nicotian is the most soothing and salutary. We must paint our great duke," Mr. Addison went on, "not as a man, which no doubt he is, with weaknesses like the rest of us, but as a hero. 'Tis in a triumph, not a battle, that your humble servant is riding his sleek Pegasus. We college poets trot, you know, on very easy knacks. It hath been, time out of mind, part of the poet's profession, to celebrate the actions of heroes in verse, and to sing the deeds which you men of war perform. I must follow the rules of my art, and the composition of such a strain as this must be harmonious and majestic, not familiar, or too near the vulgar truth. Esse parvalicit. If Virgil could invoke the divine Augustus, a humbler poet from the banks of the Isis may celebrate a victory and a conqueror of our own nation, in whose triumphs every Briton has a share, and whose glory and genius contributes to every citizen's individual honor. When hath there been, since our Henry's and Edward's days, such a great feat of arms as that from which you yourself have brought away marks of distinction? If 'tis in my power to sing that song worthily, I will do so, and be thankful to my muse. If I fail as a poet, as a Briton at least I will show my loyalty, and fling up my cap and huzza for the conqueror. Reni pecator aestri omnis in hoc uno varius discordia cessit ordinibus. Leadit erix, plaudit senator, vadic patricia certent plebia favori. " "There were as brave men on that field," says Mr. Esmond, "who never could be made to love the Duke of Marlborough, nor to forget those stories which he used to hear in his youth regarding that great chief's selfishness and treachery. Here were men at Blenheim as good as the leader, whom neither knights nor senators applauded, nor voices plebeian or patrician favored, and who lie there forgotten, under the clods. What poet is there to sing them? To sing the gallant souls of heroes sent to Hades," says Mr. Addison, with a smile. "Old, you celebrate them all? If I may venture to question anything in such an admirable work, the catalogue of the ships in Homer hath always appeared to me as somewhat wearisome. What had the poem been, supposing the writer had chronicled the names of captains, lieutenants, rank and file? One of the greatest of a great man's qualities is success. 'Tis the result of all the others. 'Tis a latent power in him which compels the favor of the gods, and subjugates fortune. Of all his gifts I admire that one in the great Marlborough. To be brave? Every man is brave. But in being victorious, as he is, I fancy there is something divine. In presence of the occasion, the great soul of the leader shines out, and the god is confessed. Death itself respects him, and passes by him to lay others low. War and carnage flee before him to ravage other parts of the field, as Hector from before the divine Achilles. You say he hath no pity, no more have the gods, who are above it, and superhuman. The fainting battle gathers strength at his aspect, and, wherever he rides, victory charges with him." A couple of days after, when Mr. Esmond revisited his poetic friend, he found this thought, struck out in the fervor of conversation, improved and shaped into those famous lines, which are in truth the noblest in the poem of the Amphion. As the two gentlemen sat engaged in talk, Mr. Addison solacing himself with his customary pipe, the little maid servant that waited on his lodging came up, preceding a gentleman in fine laced clothes, that had evidently been figuring at quarter a great man's levee. The courtier coughed a little at the smoke of the pipe, and looked round the room curiously, which was shabby enough, as was the owner in his worn, snuff-colored suit and plain tie wig. "How goes on the magnum opus, Mr. Addison?" says the court gentleman on looking down at the papers that were on the table. "We were but now over it," says Addison. "The greatest courtier in the land could not have a more splendid politeness, or greater dignity of manner. Here is the plan," says he, "on the table. Hac ibat simois, here ran the little river Nebel. Hic est sigia tellus, here are Tallard's quarters. At the bowl of this pipe, at the attack of which Captain Esmond was present, I have the honor to introduce him to Mr. Boyle." And Mr. Esmond was but now depicting aliquo prelia mixta miro, when you came in. In truth, the two gentlemen had been so engaged when the visitor arrived, and Addison, in his smiling way, speaking of Mr. Webb, Colonel of Esmond's regiment, who commanded a brigade in the action, and greatly distinguished himself there, was lamenting that he could. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.